Hi, it's Jeremy Hobson from Here and Now. Thanks for listening. And, you know, sometimes listening brings a smile to your face. Think back to a moment this past year when this show brought you some joy. Now, how about sharing that feeling? Donate to your station to pay it forward. It'll make you feel good. It will make others feel good, too. Visit donate.npr.org/now to give. Then tell us why you're spreading good vibes this season with #WhyPublicRadio.
President Donald Trump has no public events today, but he was active on Twitter this morning from Mar-a-Lago. He castigated the media for ignoring his favorable poll numbers, criticized the U.S. Postal Service, and more. But he's also given a rare sit-down interview to the newspaper he's called the, quote, failing New York Times. He's told the Times he thinks FBI Special Counsel Robert Mueller is, quote, going to be fair. But he also said the Russia investigation that Mueller is leading is bad for the country, according to the president, and that as president, he has the, quote, absolute right to do what he wants with the Justice Department. So the year ends, much as it began, with an upending of politics as usual. NPR lead political editor Domenico Montanaro joins us to discuss it all and to reveal the top two finalists in the NPR March Madness-style bracket for top political story of the year. Hello there, Domenico.
Hey, Magna.
Okay, so we're wrapping up 2017 here, talking about President Trump. First of all, what do you make of that New York Times interview?
Well, in talking about Russia and the investigation, he said that it makes America look bad. And he said that he has the absolute right to do what I want to do with the Justice Department, which, you know, most presidents have kept the Justice Department at arm's length for an optics in optics. And he said that he's stayed away from them in this case so that with the hope that he's treated fairly, which raises the question, if he starts to think he's not being treated fairly, what does he wind up doing? And, you know, it's been dangled out there that he could fire Robert Mueller, the special counsel, by firing Rod Rosenstein, who's the acting would be the acting person in charge of that investigation, given that Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, has recused himself. Trump himself says he has no intention of firing Mueller. But of course, this is going to be the big story hanging over 2018, of course.
Mm. Now, a lot of people have noted that in the New York Times interview, the president repeatedly said that there was no collusion between his campaign and Russia. He said it over and over and over again. I mean, is there any significance to that at all, or it's just in line with what he has been saying?
Well, he noted that there was no collusion and that if there was collusion, it wouldn't be a crime anyway, so it shouldn't matter, which, you know, he's getting at the point that there's no collusion statute. But of course, there are other things that the special counsel's office and the FBI have been looking at when it comes to obstruction of justice, for example. That's another issue. I mean, he's right when he says there's no collusion statute. But to kind of glibly say, well, it wouldn't even matter if there was no collusion, like a crime is the only thing that matters, you know, it certainly doesn't give the best look to things.
Yeah. Now, getting back to his comments about the Department of Justice for a second, President Trump also actually sort of in a roundabout way praised former Attorney General Eric Holder, of course, who served under the Obama administration. And Trump said that Holder protected the president, protected Obama, and that in a way he really admired that. And this was all in the context of asking for loyalty or not. I mean, if you're Jeff Sessions, do you get worried when Donald Trump says those kind of things?
You know, when protecting the president, though, is not the job of the attorney general. And it's what I think he's referring to is Eric Holder having said that he was President Obama's wingman. And that certainly raised a bunch of eyebrows because that's not what you're supposed to be doing. But what Holder was trying to get at was he's implementing the laws and is simpatico with President Obama on a lot of that. But, you know, an attorney general, one of the questions that always get asked of them is, can you be independent when you think a president does something that goes against you know, your moral judgment? And
yeah,
they always have to say yes, otherwise it won't be confirmed.
So, Domenico, forgive me. I just can't help it. It's time for a little straight talk with Domenico and Magna here on Here and Now. Because
okay. We've
spent a lot of time talking about this half-an-hour interview that the New York Times did with President Trump. I mean, do we put too much importance on things like this where you know, the president gets to sort of just say whatever he wants for half an hour? And really, is it as important, or it's not as important as the things that he actually does?
Yeah, and, we have to cover those as well. Frankly, it's a slow news week, so there's not a lot else going on, to be perfectly honest. But all over that interview, it was riddled with falsehoods.
Yeah.
And what the effort we're making today is to try to fact check what he did say so that we're giving the right information to our listeners and readers.
Okay. Well, I suppose I was just channeling the listeners out there who might be saying you shouldn't even be talking about what he's saying, but focusing more on what he does. So just wanted to put that out there. Okay, so we're looking at the big news stories of 2017, and you have this bracket of that's heading us towards the top political story of the year, selected by those same NPR listeners. How does it work?
Well, speaking of things some people think I shouldn't have done, it's important to not be too glib about, obviously, big important stories that affected the year. Well, I had this sort of idea over the weekend to, make a March Madness style bracket out of the top stories to be able to say, okay, use your news judgment here. What would you pick as the top stories? Not to say that, something is diminutive or whatever. I understand some people don't like the gamifying of politics, and I get that. And certainly we try not to do that in the broad scheme of things. But anyway, when we asked readers to dig in and see what they would pick out of all of these stories this year, overwhelmingly, they've now selected the Mueller probe, the investigation in the Mueller, the Russia investigation, and the fallout from sexual harassment as the two biggest political stories of the year. And people will get to vote on those on Twitter this afternoon, and we'll know which one they think was the bigger story of the year sometime later this afternoon.
Terrific. Domenico Montanaro is NPR's lead political editor. It's always great to talk to you, Domenico, and early wishes for a happy new year.
Same to you. Thank you.
Nearly 47 million Americans are aged 65 years or older. As senior citizens age, they're more likely to need help from caregivers. There are some 40 million family caregivers out there. Of them, 40% are men. That's according to the American Association of Retired Persons. In 2009, it was 34%. Kathy Ritchie from member station KJZZ reports on the changing face of caregiving.
Let me tell you about the toughest guy on earth.
He has the crazy strength to lift the man that raised him up without even flinching.
That's Hollywood tough guy Danny Trejo in a PSA produced by AARP as part of its Tougher Than Tough campaign, encouraging male caregivers to get the help and support they need to do what is a difficult job.
Caregiving is tougher than tough. Find the care guides you need at aarp.org/caregiving.
The men you're going to hear from in this story probably wouldn't say they're the toughest guy on earth. In fact, they'll tell you they do what they do out of love, and because if not them, who? Yet the typical family caregiver is not a man, according to AARP. It's a 49-year-old woman.
We don't yet live in a world where men and women experience the burdens of life, as well as the burdens of caregiving equally.
Addison Deal has been taking care of his mother, who has Parkinson's disease, for more than 6 years at home. Like a lot of caregivers, Deal had to leave his job in education. Today, he and his mother live on our pension and a small sum he receives from the Arizona Long-Term Care System as a paid caregiver. He worries about his financial future.
I'm grateful that nonetheless I'm recognized as a professional giving caregiving services in the home.
That distinction is important to Deal. Like a lot of male caregivers, he's experienced a loss of professional identity. And that's why Deal now facilitates a bi-monthly support group for men.
Cool. You're on here. You can just sign in. Did name tags make their way around?
They did.
According to AARP, few male caregivers ask for support. They don't want to talk about their feelings. But here, they can express their frustrations or ask for help.
In some cases, it can even be my loved one has been violent towards me, verbally or physically. I think my loved one might need to be placed in a care facility. What is that like? Has anyone done that before?
One of the men at the table is Don Cook. He came here after starting to care for his wife, who was diagnosed with dementia.
I don't want to forget who I am. I want to reinforce that every day. And I love her. I want her to know that she's not abandoned.
Unfortunately, Cook's wife died late last month. He's grateful that she's no longer suffering, but he knows the journey doesn't end with her passing. He says he'll continue to attend support group meetings to help those who are coming up behind him. And he knows one day, relief will be replaced with grief.
This is not the retirement that I had in mind. but this is the retirement I've got.
You know, I take her clothes home every day, and I wash them once a week with mine.
That's former Arizona Congressman Harry Mitchell. He spends every morning with his wife, Marianne, who has Alzheimer's disease. He helps her with her breakfast. He takes her to get her hair and nails done.
Somebody told me that every family ought to have a daughter, because that's who's going to take care of you when you get old. And I said, well, maybe, but, you know, I think it is an expectation that women will do that. And that's unfortunate.
Mitchell has become an advocate for caregivers, but he's an exception. And when male caregivers don't seek help, Deal says,
what builds up is unrelenting, unimaginable pressure, and they often break in really gruesome ways.
Which can include prolonged isolation, even murder-suicide, says Deal. As our population continues to age and life expectancy increases, more husbands and sons will become caregivers, continuing to redefine traditional gender roles and expectations. For Here and Now, I'm Kathy Ritchie.
Call them what you will, labor camps, refugee camps, concentration camps. For more than a century, governments have found ways to round up certain groups of people, relocate them, and isolate them. Often they say it's a necessary action to protect the citizenry at large. Sometimes they claim they're actually trying to protect the very people they're rounding up. The reality is that these camps have been deeply dehumanizing places where some of history's worst atrocities have taken place. Journalist Andrea Pitzer explores the history and the current incarnations of these camps in her book called One Long Night. She tracks them back to the 1890s and the start of the Spanish-American War when the USS Maine came under fire in Cuba.
You know, it's interesting. In 1898, everybody remembers the Maine, you know, remember the Maine, to hell with Spain, is the reason that the U.S. entered the Spanish-American War.
The sinking of the U.S. warship.
Exactly, when the warship exploded. But the reason the U.S. was primed to go to war was because for more than a year they had been seeing all kinds of coverage, including photos of people starving and dying in these concentration camps. And we had been sending relief supplies, food and beans and, you know, condensed milk to try to help these people in these camps. And we really saw what Spain was doing as an outrage. And President McKinley, when he called for war with Spain, talked about this. And he said this policy of these concentration camps was not war by any civilized means. It was extermination and leads basically to nothing but the wilderness and the grave. It was a very dramatic thing.
So as you say, though, I mean, this is almost inconceivable given what the U.S. was doing there, coming to the rescue of these people. The U.S. implemented these kind of detention centers later in the Philippines.
Yes. Well, it's one of those things where when faced with the same circumstances, when the U.S. inherited the Philippines from Spain after the war and was faced itself with an insurgency, it was very hard to ignore this sort of new tool that they had seen lying around not that long ago. And it was an interesting argument, though, because the people against them said, but the president just said they were terrible in Spain. And then other people had to argue, well, he wasn't saying that in an official capacity. So you get into this doublespeak about camps very, very early on.
In the book, you go into some detail on the early days of what we think of as a concentration camp these days, and that is what happened in World War II. How did the concentration camps that we think of now start? Because they didn't start with the massive camps and people being brought in by the thousands in the beginning.
No, they didn't. So there was that first sort of decade or so of these colonial camps, and then they kind of fell into disrepute. Then in World War I, there was massive use of it, and you went from almost no camps in the world. By the end of World War I, they were on six continents. So when the Nazi camps started, they looked very much to outside eyes like things that had been done in Soviet Russia or in internment camps during World War I. And a lot of people don't realize that it's really 5 or 6 years before the Nazis begin to target Jews as a group to arrest and detain in camps. And even after that, they let almost all of them go at one point. They wanted the Jews to leave the country. But it's when the world didn't do much about it that I think is a big part of the reason that the Nazis realized they might use the camps at the heart of another kind of strategy.
You say when the world didn't do much about it, meaning countries, including the United States, did not open their arms to the Jews who were being cast out.
Right. There was still a decided and public lack of willingness to host refugees.
And you say that bolstered the movement toward the concentration camps as we know them.
It did, because the Nazis had terrorized the Jews for this period during Kristallnacht in November 1938, and the world really didn't do much about it. And they realized that they could do some pretty awful things and get away with it.
At the same time, the United States was interning Japanese Americans. Where do you put that in your research?
I include that as part of the larger concentration camp tapestry. You know, when people think of camps, they just think of the death camps. They think of Auschwitz. But really, there's this century-long history of all different kinds of camps, transit camps, deportation camps, internment camps, labor camps. But I would definitely put the Japanese-American internment in that category, especially since the majority of those interned were U.S. citizens.
After World War II, the mantra was never again. We have seen versions, though, of detention centers that are entirely brutal. One of them that comes to mind right now that's very much in the news is with the Rohingyas, the Muslim minorities in Myanmar or Burma. They are being forced out and have been for some time now forced out, and many are in refugee camps now in Bangladesh. You have visited the refugees and spoken with them. Tell us about that.
I actually went to Myanmar in 2015. People had been there at that point for 3 years, and they were quite hopeful ahead of the elections that were going to happen that fall. And in fact, Aung San Suu Kyi did come in, but in that time after the elections, the people that I kept in touch with after I returned to the U.S. really seemed to lose hope. I think that they thought not that she would dissolve the camps overnight, but that some kind of progress would be made. And when no progress was made, I think a real general despair set in, and we ended up on this path that we're on today, in which the government has really been brutalizing the Rohingya.
Tell us about one of the conversations that you remember most.
Well, one of the interpreters that I was dealing with there that took me around the camp, so a Rohingya man in the camps, we were talking about it, and I said, couldn't you go out at night? Couldn't you make your way out of here? You know, why does everyone stay? And he said that he couldn't, that like even if he got out, it wouldn't matter because everybody would know he was a Rohingya. This was his hometown. This was, you know, he would be recognized. And I said, what would happen if you were caught? Would you get a trial case? What would happen? And he said, if I'm caught, I don't even exist. And that was his sense of where the people were. They were stateless. They've been stripped of everything. No one would be accountable if something happened to him.
There are some pretty amazing instances of how people managed to escape various camps.
Right. And one of my favorite examples is in the first months of Dachau, there was a communist deputy from the Reichstag who managed to escape after days and days of horrific torture, managed to sneak out with a little help through a tiny window at the top of his cell. And he got out of the country and he sent a postcard to the guards at the camp with an expletive in it telling them exactly what they could do with themselves. So, but in addition, the prisoners found ways to swap bodies. They found ways to put on circuses and entertain each other. Sometimes the guards would watch. Sometimes they would do this secretly. They would share recipes with each other. The amazing things people did sort of to sustain themselves, it's pretty incredible.
What was it like, Andrea, for you to go through this entire process? I mean, it must have been arduous. I know you traveled great distances for it. Tell us what it was like.
Well, I felt really honored by the stories that people shared with me of the things that they had gone through and overcome. But it was also very hard. I found myself writing slower and slower and slower. And the book took me almost a year more than I expected it to initially. And I think it was just the weight of this history. And also that it's still going on. You know, Guantanamo is a piece of this history. And I'm still in touch with those Rohingya people that I met in the camp. Some of them I'm still able to contact. I talk with them every week. So it's not a dead, closed history. It's an ongoing thing. And the burden of hoping that the book will do something about that, I still feel that today.
How are those people doing, by the way, the Rohingyas you speak with?
The ones that I'm in touch with are sort of holding fast. They are below the area that the military has sort of been burning villages in and forcing people across the border. So for right now, that hasn't affected them much. They are still in the camp setting. But of course, it makes it clear what the federal government is willing to do and what could happen at any time. So it's very precarious and nerve-wracking. But so far, they haven't come to physical harm.
Did you come to any kind of conclusion as to what it is about humanity that allows this to happen and that even conceives of the idea of setting up camps like these?
Well, what I found that I think is a really important takeaway is, and it does provide a little hope, people have to be coached to do this. This is not something that arises sort of independently out of nowhere. There are always going to be some narrow band of people who want to harm other groups. That always exists. But you really have to put the force of a government or a party or a huge institution behind it and do sustained propaganda to get people to go along with it, to make people hateful, but even more so fearful enough to allow this kind of stuff to happen. So I think the key is strengthening these institutions that don't allow this to happen is really, really critical for us. So it is something that, having been introduced into the world, is unlikely to leave it. But at the same time, it isn't something that's just going to automatically arise on its own.
The book is called One Long Night, and it's by Andrea Pitzer, our guest today. Thank you, Andrea, very much.
Thank you for having me on.
You can read an excerpt of the book and see pictures from some of the camps at hereandnow.org. Writers have long wrestled with the reality of evil in the world. Poets have, too. Early this year in Dublin, the Irish poet Michael Cody read aloud one of his own works, A Reflection of Evil and Good.
Though there are torturers in the world, there are also musicians. Though at this moment men are screaming in prisons, there are jazzmen raising storms of sensuous celebration and orchestras releasing glories of the spirit. Though the image of God is everywhere defiled, a man in West Clare is playing the concertina. The Sistine Choir is levitating under the dome of St. Peter's, and a drunk man on the road is singing for no reason.
It was a good holiday season for retailers. Sales up 4.9%, according to MasterCard's Spending Plus report. Of course, that means that Amazon also had a great month. The company said in a statement that it was, quote, a record holiday shopping season. But this morning, President Donald Trump tweeted, quote, why is the United States Post Office, which is losing many billions of dollars a year while charging Amazon and others so little to deliver their packages, making Amazon richer and the post office dumber and poorer should be charging more, exclamation point, end quote. Well, Mike Regan is senior editor at Bloomberg News, and he joins us now. And hi, Mike. 2017 isn't quite over yet, is it?
Hi, Magnet. You got that whole tweet in one breath there. That's impressive.
Going out with a flare here. Okay. So let's break down what the president has tweeted out here. What does he mean by he thinks Amazon is not paying the Postal Service enough to ship its packages?
Well, this has been an issue that some people on Wall Street and in the money management community have brought up. In particular, a fund manager named Josh Sanbolte made some waves earlier this year by claiming in a Wall Street Journal opinion piece that he believed the Postal Service was undercharging Amazon. He cited an analysis by Citigroup that said if the costs were fairly allocated, on average, parcels would cost about $1.46 more on average to deliver. So the post office is required by law to charge customers at least the cost of their costs for delivering packages. But it is true that they consistently lose money in large part because of the cost for retiree health insurance and pensions and that sort of thing. And the way the mail, the composition of the mail in the age of the internet has changed dramatically so that it's less first-class mail, letters and postcards, that sort of things, right, and a lot more packages. And it's very hard to sort out what costs what.
I was curious. Sorry, Mike, just to jump in here. I was curious, like, is the post office charging Amazon bulk rates or, you know, because we're talking about, like, millions of packages here.
Right. I mean, and it's important to point out that Amazon ships so many packages that it uses a wide variety of shippers, including the post office, FedEx, UPS, local regional services. The estimate is that about 40% of the shipments are through the regular post office, at least in past years. And it's hard to know exactly. Again, it's hard to break down those costs per package and know exactly what each one's cost, because your mailman delivers letters and postcards and packages all at once. So it's a very tricky thing to say for sure.
Okay, so to this part where the president says should be charging much more, that process, though, has to go through a commission, though, right?
Right. Well, you know, Amazon has a special relationship with the post office. It was part of the reason why the post office started more weekend deliveries. I think this tweet from President Trump raises a number of questions about that. I think there's going to be further scrutiny of it. And it wouldn't be surprising if there is, you know, some decision on how to handle this.
You know, my thought is we saw Amazon do some last mile stuff this season, too, with Amazon Flex. So it may just only be a matter of time before they stop using the Postal Service altogether. But, hey, that's my prediction for, I don't know, 2020. We'll see. Mike Regan, senior editor at Bloomberg News. Always great to have you, and Happy New Year, Mike.
You too, Michael. Thank you.
Author Peter Zeutlin never wanted a dog. His wife finally talked him into it when they became empty nesters in New England. By some miracle, she even talked him into a rescue dog, a stray. Zeutlin had always believed, as a lot of people do, that rescue dogs are second-rate goods, damaged beyond repair. Well, now he can't imagine life without a dog, or two, or three at last count. What changed his mind about adopting a stray dog was Albie. Albie is part lab, part golden retriever, and part who knows what. Zeutlin fell head over heels for Albie. He never thought that would happen. These days, he's become so dismayed by the issue of stray dogs in America that he's written two books about it. His newest is called Rescued. It tracks former strays that have, against the odds, been given a second chance. Dogs like Albie.
Well, Albie had been picked up as a stray in central Louisiana and brought to a high-kill shelter where 9 out of 10 dogs never leave and most never last more than a week. So that's really what led me down this road and led me to write two books about rescue dogs now, in part to preach the gospel of rescue and try and persuade people to adopt and not shop when they're looking for a dog, but also just better understand the world that my dogs have come from.
I was especially touched by one thing that you have said about Albie. You look at him and you just wish that he could tell you what his puppyhood was like, because you know that it was not good.
Yeah. In the early days, you know, he has these big, soulful brown eyes. And I looked into his eyes and I just wanted to know his story. You know, did he ever have a family before? I wanted to know if anybody had ever hurt or abused him, how long he'd been out there wandering through the wilds of central Louisiana. And then he got scooped up and, you know, brought to a shelter, which is never a good place for a dog to have to be.
And it's amazing he survived.
He was very lucky. He had a guardian angel there, a volunteer at the shelter, who literally week by week was getting him a stay of execution with the shelter director until she could get him into the Labs for Rescue program and find an adopter for him. So he was a true underdog in every sense of the word, as most of these dogs who make it up here and find their forever homes up here. They're all underdogs.
So I'm going to get tough now, because as wonderful as Albie may be and as wonderful as rescue dogs may be, and I have personal experience that they are fantastic, there are a lot of difficulties that can come specifically with rescue dogs. I mean, they can come with any dog,
right.
But separation anxiety, lack of socialization skills because in part they may not have had families previously, barking because they've never been trained to keep it all contained and keep other things contained in the house as well. Where do those go in your kind of rationalization?
Well, first of all, if people work with a reputable rescue organization, and they should get references before they do, those organizations work hard to make sure these dogs are socialized and ready to be placed in a home. You know, they're temperament tested, they're socialized. You know, you have to appreciate that these dogs sometimes have come from difficult circumstances, but in the vast, vast majority of cases, they're so ready to be loved and to love back. Dogs, I think, draw us out of our own heads and help us to live more in the moment.
I think one of the things also fueling your passion is that there's a far greater supply than demand for rescue dogs. It's really astonishing when you look at the numbers of how many strays there are across, not even talking about other countries where you can see them on highways, streets, but in this country.
in this country, we're euthanizing – I mean, estimates vary. There are no hard statistics, but probably about 750,000 dogs a year. And people are often – very often surprised when I tell them that the picture that you painted of dogs running on highways and so forth, this is not just a third world problem. It exists here in the United States. And I learned that firsthand while working on my previous book, Rescue Road, when I spent time in Houston, where there is a stray population of over 1 million dogs.
Stray dogs in Houston.
In Houston alone. And you do see them running all over the roads and, you know, through parking lots. And, you know, these shelters, they're dealing with an incredibly difficult problem where they may have a shelter that can, you know, hold 100 dogs, and every week 100 more strays are coming in, and where do they go? They're dealing with a problem that in some parts of the country is really cascaded out of control.
Is that in part because of a lack of rules that have to do with neutering or spaying a dog?
At some level, that's true, that there are parts of the country where there isn't a strong spay-neuter culture, but the question is, why not? I don't have an easy answer to that. But keep in mind that if you're dealing with a population, as in Houston, of 1 million strays, there's no one to bring those dogs to get spayed and neutered. This problem has escalated to the point where it would take, you know, decades of a concentrated spay-neuter program in a city like Houston to begin to reduce the numbers. So,
and it takes money for the owner,
It takes money. It's often not a high priority in cash-strapped cities. And frankly, the shelters are not often high priorities for governments either when they've got competing demands from the school department, the police department, the fire department, parks, you know, sanitation. You know, who speaks for the dogs? I'm often asked when I give talks about these books, you know, what's the solution? What can we do? And unfortunately, there's no easy answer to that.
What happened in Houston, by the way, to the dogs during and after Hurricane Harvey?
This is a catastrophe not only for the people who live there, but for these animals as well. At one shelter in Dickinson, Texas, the shelter there was overwhelmed with intake and strays that were coming in. And one of those strays was a little, maybe not a stray, maybe a dog abandoned, was a little puppy just several weeks old left in a shoebox.
This is a little spotted
little
black,
white and black pit bull mix. And she was, when she was brought into the shelter by the person who found her, she was diagnosed with parvo, which is a very serious virus, almost always fatal if untreated and sometimes very difficult to treat. Very sick dog. And she found her guardian angel at the shelter, a man named Tom English, who came to volunteer, experienced dog rescuer who I had met while researching my previous book, Rescue Road. And Tom talked to the veterinarian at the shelter, also a volunteer, to try and work out a treatment plan for her, antibiotics and so forth. And he took her back to his house to try and nurse her back to health and to save her. And a few weeks later, she recovered.
Amazingly.
She beat incredible odds. And
she had her own Facebook page, is that right? Or Tom put her on his
Tom
Facebook
English
page?
Tom English started posting pictures on his Facebook page. And I called Tom after the hurricane to see how he was doing. And he told me about this little dog named Stormy. And I ended up writing an article about her. Incredibly, a doctor in North Carolina read about Stormy, tracked Tom English down, and the doctor, it turns out, is also a private pilot. He flew down to Texas and met her and ended up taking her back to his farm in North Carolina. And Stormy now has four other rescued dog siblings that she lives with. You know, very happy ending for one little dog, but God knows how many, you know, perished in that storm. But when people say to me, you know, well, why a rescue dog? Stormy's one answer, an absolutely beautiful, adorable, lovable dog that just needed someone to step up.
There are more and more people adopting rescue dogs these days. So in that way, it's some good news in here. And there are outlets that make it easier for people to maybe get indoctrinated into the rescue dog life. Tell me about an experience you had in Turks and Caicos.
We went on vacation to Turks and Caicos, to the main island down there a few years ago, and we were missing our dogs, and we found out there was a local rescue on the island that sends dogs to North America, but they always look for tourists to help socialize these dogs. So every morning, Judy and I walked over, and we got to check out a puppy, gave us a little bag with treats and water and a ball, go across the street to the beach, and just spend a morning on the beach with an adorable puppy. And
pet for a day with a purpose.
Pet for a day with a purpose. And if you go down there, check it out. It's called Potcake Place. It'll lift your spirits, and you'll be doing something great for these dogs.
Peter Zeutlin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Lisa.
Peter Zeutlin's book is called Rescued, What Second Chance Dogs Teach Us About Living with Purpose, Loving with Abandon, and Finding Joy in the Little Things.
Race was a big part of the national conversation this year, including in sports, as NFL players and some team owners kneeled during the national anthem to protest police violence against people of color. President Trump, though, blasted them on Twitter and at rallies.
That's a total disrespect of our heritage. That's a total disrespect of everything that we stand for, okay? Everything that we stand for.
Well, the issue of race is not only playing out in professional sports, but also in high school athletics. Anlie Herring of WESA has this report from Pittsburgh.
The same night President Trump first announced protests of NFL players, racial tensions emerged at a football game between Pittsburgh's Perry High School and West Virginia's Brooke High School. Students from Brooke greeted their opponents with a banner that said Trump Perry. The students, who are white, say it was a clever play on the fact that the president's name also means to beat or defeat. But to their visitors from Perry, where 75% of students are black, it was racially insensitive and even intimidating. The incident led to finger-pointing and anger among students and parents from both schools, and ultimately an apology from Brooke's superintendent and an agreement to move on. At Pittsburgh's Obama Academy, members of the soccer team say they often encounter racially charged behavior on the field. Obama is an urban public school where over 70% of students are black. 15-year-old Brandon Sears started playing soccer for Obama this fall, and he remembers the first time an opposing player called him the N-word.
I was shocked, but then again I wasn't, because knowing that I'm black and he's white, something happens.
Sears was tempted to fight, but he didn't. He followed the advice he got at the beginning of the season in a discussion that has become custom for his team, says assistant coach Christopher Thyberg.
Usually, like, the only thing that we can do is ask the players to try to be the bigger person, which is a very unfair request to tell them, hey, you're going to get racially abused, but you have to, you know, not respond to it.
The captain of Obama Academy's soccer team, 17-year-old Ian Thomas, who is white, says his teammates of color are targeted both verbally and physically.
What would happen is, the kid starts talking. He starts talking in his ear, and then it just, that kind of ramps up. It gets more and more intense as the game goes on. Elbows are being thrown. Kids are, like, stomping, like, they're cleating each other intentionally, tripping each other.
Thomas acknowledges that it's the nature of competition to take some cheap shots to get into your opponent's head. But something about race, his instincts tell him, crosses the line.
You get on the field, your mindset changes, you get a little more tense, and it gets aggressive. But, like, I question if it would be different with my players of color that are on the team. Like, would they be so kind to them outside of the field as they might be to me?
When Brandon Sears was first called a slur by another player, he was angry. Though he'd rather forget about the whole issue, he says it still bothers him.
It does happen a lot. And that's the sad part about it. Like, you're not there to call people names. You're there to compete.
I'm disappointed that sports haven't seemed to help race relations very much.
Larry Davis is dean of the University of Pittsburgh School of Social Work. He's devoted his career to the study of race and social justice and says the performance of black athletes has long been perceived as a challenge to white masculinity. For example, in 1910, when black heavyweight champion Jack Johnson defeated white boxer Jim Jeffries in what was dubbed the fight of the century, race riots broke out across the country. And when Hank Aaron broke Babe Ruth's home run record in 1974, he received thousands of death threats.
It's for sort of dominance of who's the better group. I mean, I hate to put it that way, but that's kind of what it's about.
Yet Davis suggests that race relations might actually be worse if it weren't for sports and its ability to facilitate interaction across races. Coach Thyberg of Obama Academy remembers a game where one of his white players joked that a foul against a teammate of color must have been racially motivated. Another player on the bench, Thyberg says, made it a teachable moment.
He wasn't rude or mean-spirited, but he called him out on it and said, "Why is that funny to you?" And had this exchange where he was able to say, like, it's not funny when this is happening to me on the field. After that, I didn't see it happen again.
But other schools say race continues to be a problem. This fall, a football game near Pittsburgh erupted into a bench-clearing brawl because, according to some of the players, their opponents were hurling racial slurs. In response, the Western Pennsylvania Interscholastic Athletic League sent a letter to schools condemning racially insensitive comments. Executive Director Tim O'Malley says educators and families must take the lead in correcting unsportsmanlike behavior.
How do you put an end to it? I think from an educational standpoint, there's a responsibility to try to continue to work with the kids in your schools, with your children, to make sure that they understand what is and isn't acceptable.
He says student-athletes should be learning sportsmanship, not undermining. For Here and Now, I'm Anlie Herring in Pittsburgh.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. Robin Young is back on Monday as we ring in the new year. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Lisa Mullins. This is Here and Now.